And good afternoon. Welcome to Monday's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is away. In Roxane Gay's debut novel, An Untamed State, a Haitian-American attorney lives a fairy tale existence in Miami with her husband and baby son. All that changes after she visits her wealthy parents in Port-au-Prince. A gang of thugs kidnaps her, and when her father refuses to pay ransom, she's subjected to unspeakable suffering. Her captors release her eventually, but her ordeal is far from over. This is a riveting, heartfelt portrait of a once confident, joyful, and independent woman who must now struggle to maintain her sanity as she slowly emerges from the dark pit of sexual violence. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Gay. He began by asking her how a novelist can write about the subject of rape without being exploitative.
That's a really good question, and I don't know that I've found the answer. But for me, the answer was to write directly at it instead of around it. I didn't want it to be stylized. I didn't want it to be glamorous or pretty. I wanted it to be as raw and ugly as the experience can be. And I wanted people to feel like they had to look away, because I think if you don't feel compelled to look away, then we haven't quite done our job as either movie filmmakers or television producers or writers.
Well, I'd like to quote something from an essay you wrote. Mm-hmm. The way we currently represent rape in books, in newspapers, on television, on the silver screen, often allows us to ignore the material realities of rape, the impact of rape, the meaning of rape. What do you mean?
I feel like oftentimes, especially movies have done this, you look and you see a woman is raped, and then there's a shower sequence, and there's a recovery sequence, and then a sequence where she's finding her happily ever after, where everything turns out okay. And you don't really sort of know about the physical or emotional toll that may have been taken. And so with this novel, I really wanted to explore that a little more materially. How does this affect the body? How does it affect the mind? And it is explicit, and I struggled with that very much because I don't want it to be exploitative or gratuitous. But it felt right for this novel. And I think that other writers make different choices, but this was the right choice for An Untamed State.
Well, the story is about a young Haitian-American woman, an attorney, mm-hmm. who from a affluent family.
Yes.
She seems to have, as you would put it, or as she puts it, a fairy tale life.
Yes.
And then what happens?
The fairy tale is shattered. She's kidnapped when she's visiting her parents in Port-au-Prince with her American husband and infant son. And then she's held for 13 days because her father is reluctant to pay the ransom. He worries that if he pays the ransom once, he's going to have to pay another ransom and another, because he has a large family. And he doesn't want to see criminals take away everything he's worked so hard for. And so he puts his pride and stubbornness above his daughter's well-being. And so the novel really looks at what she endures during the kidnapping and how she comes to terms with realizing that her life was a fairy tale before the kidnapping, and then see how it shatters after, and how she tries to come back to the woman she once was after she is released eventually.
We're speaking with Roxane Gay about her new novel, An Untamed State. I've never been to Haiti. Mm-hmm. But I would like to visit.
You should.
I do. I would like to visit. But the way you portray Haiti, I've spoken with some Haitians, mm-hmm. and discussed the way some of the scenes, mm-hmm. in the novel. And they've been a little bit, how can I put it, uncomfortable with the way you depict the nation. Mm-hmm. You emphasize the squalor, the income inequality. Have you gotten any backlash?
Not yet, but I expect it.
Uh-huh.
But I also don't think it's fair, because when people write novels about terrible things that happen in the United States, no one tells that American writer that they don't like what they're saying about Chicago or Denver or any other city. And so I don't know why I would be held to a different standard simply because I'm a Haitian American writer. And I think one of the things the novel also makes clear is that Haiti contains multitudes. And it is a gorgeous country. I've never seen a more beautiful place. But I've also never seen an uglier place. And I think that those two realities do coexist. And I was definitely exploring them in this novel.
Part of Haiti is the income inequality.
Yes.
The extreme poverty.
Yes.
And the men who perpetrate these crimes on your protagonist.
Yes.
They were brought up in this society.
Yes.
I was wondering if you were making any connection between the economic deprivation and sexual violence, that in some way they go hand in hand.
Yes and no. I think the connection I was making more explicitly was, how desperate do you have to be to steal someone from their life? What does it take to get to that point? The sexual violence, you know, I think that's something that happens in these situations to women and to men when they are so unfortunate as to be kidnapped. But I don't think they're intrinsically connected. I think it's something that happens to her while she's there, but I don't think it's something that rises out of poverty. I think that rape happens everywhere and at every economic class and level. So no, that connection is not there. The connection is simply, how desperate do you have to be to lose moral grounding?
There's a sense of powerlessness.
Yes. And they're trying to fight against that in any way they can. And then, of course, the leader of the men who kidnapped Mireille, he's just a sadist. I mean, he's a criminal. He's a criminal anywhere in the world. And he tries to justify his criminality and his sadism, but there is no justification for his behavior, no matter what he thinks.
We're speaking with Roxane Gay, whose new novel is An Untamed State. Well, about that particular character, mm-hmm. he calls himself the Commander.
Mm-hmm.
And he tries to defend his actions mm-hmm. using politics.
Yes.
And I could not help thinking about the Nigerian girls. Who, of course, were kidnapped
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately are still being held captive. And that video by the commander of the Boko Haram,
mm-hmm.
that this man dressed up in this uniform and spouting all these Islamist ideological nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
This is a type.
Yes.
We've seen this over and over and over again, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. I think that self-proclaimed prophets and idols are absolutely full of nonsense ideology. And of course, they want to give themselves grand titles like the Commander. And they want to make videos and make statements and act as if they are speaking the truth about their religious zeal or their political zeal, when oftentimes they really are narcissists who only stand for themselves. With the leader of Boko Haram, it's absolutely heartbreaking to consider the scope of the situation. Not one or two, but 230 or more young girls were kidnapped, and they justify this because of religion. I don't know any god that would justify this kind of thing. And I think when you see the gravity of the situation and you see the delusion of that leader in his video, you start to understand why these kinds of crimes take place. It's because these charismatic figures assume positions of leadership and people follow along because they really want to believe that this person somehow is an arbiter of truth.
Well, the thing I noticed in your novel, and also I think with the Boko Haram situation, is that this is a real dehumanization
mm-hmm.
of women.
Yes.
They are a complete objectification of women. Mm-hmm. They cannot see women as other humans, mm-hmm. as their fellow human.
Mm-hmm.
It's like what Martin Buber, the the Jewish philosopher said in his book, I, Thou, that there is the I, Thou relationship and the I, It relationship. Mm-hmm. And the I, Thou relationship is when I do see you as my sister or my brother, even though I might hate you, I might still kill you.
We can still be
in a battlefield and I can still kill you, but hey, I know I've killed a human being. But then there's the I, It relationship where, no, I've completely dehumanized you.
Yes. And I think the commander and Boko Haram, they I don't even think they view other men as human. I think they care about themselves only. And women are a very convenient political target the world over. And you definitely see this sense of dehumanization because these men have this power over these women. And this is something they can get away with. And, you know, look at CNN. CNN is religiously covering the MH370, the plane. Even last night I was watching CNN and they were still talking about the plane and there was a dispute over a ping. This shows you how we value women in this world. That this plane, this piece of hardware, I mean, I do mourn for the people who are lost and that I take no pleasure. I think it's tragic, but I think that those people are dead and the plane is buried beneath fathoms and we may never retrieve it, but we can still save these girls. And that all the news networks continue to obsess over the whereabouts of the plane and what this sound means, I think it shows exactly what the world thinks of women.
I never realized that, but it's true. We need to take a break.
Okay.
When we return, we'll continue speaking with novelist and essayist Roxane Gay. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is novelist and essayist Roxane Gay. Ms. Gay's first novel, An Untamed State, is the story of a Haitian-American woman who is kidnapped while visiting her parents in Port-au-Prince. She is also the author of a collection of essays on race, gender, and sexuality entitled Bad Feminist. Roxane, the thing about your novel, the entire novel impressed me, but what really impressed me was the second half.
Oh, thank you.
Because the first half is a horror show. It is.
Yes.
You go into detail about the torture, and it is torture.
It is.
And that's what people don't understand. Rape is torture.
Yes.
Rape is a form of torture.
Absolutely.
They don't seem to understand that. They seem to separate the two.
Yeah, they seem to think it's only this sexual thing or that it's violence, but it's torture. It's a way of breaking someone down. Mm-hmm. And in the novel, the commander tries to break Mireille down because I think that's the only power that he has.
But she, and you know, I'm not giving anything away by saying that she is released at some point, or
yes,
she is freed at some point. And the second half of the novel deals with the aftermath,
yes,
of the trauma. What were you trying to do in that part of the novel?
I was definitely trying to show how difficult it can be to overcome trauma, and that it's not a tidy process, and that it's not something that can happen in a week or a month or even a year. And so I was trying to chronicle how someone would emerge from a situation like this and be in shock, I think, in the initial days and weeks and even months, and how they start to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder. And she is a wife and a mother, and so in addition to trying to come back to herself, she also has to try and find a way to come back to her family. And I wanted to show how this is a crime that affects not just a person who has been kidnapped and who has been raped, it affects the people in her life as well. And so to a lesser extent, I was very interested in exploring how this would reverberate throughout her family.
I've heard that you originally did not want to give this novel a happy ending or anything, a sort of positive ending.
At first, the ending was, it wasn't unhappy, but it was a little darker. It was less hopeful. And then I realized, oh, you can't do that to the reader, especially given the darkness of the first half of the novel. I think you have to give the reader something, not a gift, but a sort of a reward for having stuck with the novel that entire time. And so after talking with my editor and really thinking about it and questioning myself as to why I wanted to make it a dark ending, I did revisit the ending, and I hope that the book ends in its own way on a hopeful note.
Well, the character of the father is problematic.
Yes.
He's a self-made man. Mm-hmm. He's admirable in the sense that he came from nothing and achieved great things. Mm-hmm. But the way he acts is inexcusable.
Yes.
But there are men like that. Mm-hmm. They're so proud. They're so stubborn. They would sacrifice their families for their principles.
Yes. And I think he's someone who has long sacrificed his family for his principles. When he was very domineering when the children were younger and always expecting them to be excellent, and that never changes. And I think that, again, people are made into what they are. And I think that's what poverty did to him. It made him driven and it made him relentless. And I think he lost a part of his soul in that process. And in doing so, he lost the ability to realize what was truly at stake with his daughter being held. He had somehow deluded himself into thinking this was only about money, but it was about, I think, so much more. It was about class privilege and people railing against that class privilege. And I think because of where he started from, he was unable to recognize that he had become part of the problem in Haiti with his wealth and living behind his gated walls.
Well, also, because how do you pronounce her first name?
Mireille.
Mireille, okay. Mireille is failed by every man. Mm-hmm. In her life. That's the sad thing about it.
Yes.
She doesn't have any male who really understands what she's going through. Her husband, Michael, mm-hmm. who's not a bad man.
No.
He's a perfectly nice man, a good husband, good father. He's a white American. Mm-hmm. And a fish out of water in Haiti.
Yes.
And he does everything wrong.
Yes.
After the trauma. After the trauma, as she's trying to cope with it, he does everything wrong. But unfortunately, a lot of men do things wrong because they don't understand what their wives or girlfriends have gone through.
Yes. In the original version, he did everything right, and it just seemed too good. It seemed too Prince Charming and too pat and convenient. And so I wanted to complicate it a bit because I don't think that there's a right way to respond to a situation like this. Like, how on earth do you deal with your wife being kidnapped for 13 days and then coming home as a completely different person? And so he does get to a better place. And in the end, he does rise to the occasion, but it takes him some time to get there. And I think it would take anyone time to get there. And so I have a soft spot for Michael, even though he definitely is frustrating in the initial days after the kidnapping, where he doesn't quite know what to do and he doesn't seem to have the necessary empathy to at least begin to understand the situation his wife is in. But this is a story where especially the father has failed his daughter. He has failed his wife. He has failed himself, I think. And that's a difficult thing. But I was very interested in exploring that because I think and it was just something I was interested in exploring.
We're speaking with Roxane Gay, whose new novel is An Untamed State. You've also written a book of essays.
Yes.
Bad Feminist.
Yes.
That's the title, provocative title.
Yes, it is.
What is a bad feminist?
You know, I started calling myself a bad feminist tongue-in-cheek, just kidding around, because I do believe I'm a feminist, but there are opinions I have and things I do that may be considered anti-feminist, and I was trying to find a way to reconcile that. And then I just realized that, perfect feminism was not something I was ever going to be able to achieve, and so I just accept that I'm a bad feminist, but at least I am a feminist, and I'm trying to become a better feminist always. And so I honestly think a bad feminist is just a human being who sometimes has contradictions, but ultimately believes in the equality of women and freeing women from oppression.
Well, the word feminist has acquired negative connotation.
It really has.
Susan Faludi in her book Backlash talks about how the word changed, principally in the 1980s, because of conservatives.
Yes.
Like Rush Limbaugh, who called feminists feminazis. But you do have an issue with contemporary feminism, I think. What is the issue?
My frustration with contemporary feminism is that all too often it prioritizes the interests of middle class to upper middle class white women above all else. And it's very narrow. It's the kind of thinking that says, okay, once we fix women's problems, then we can get to working class women's problems, and then we can get to queer women's problems. And so they don't think about the intersections between the way identities that people hold. They just think, okay, we're going to solve this problem first. And this is the way feminism has acted historically. And it's frustrating to be in 2014 and still see people trying to compartmentalize how we move forward and help people. And so I do have issues, but I think a lot of people that have issues disavow feminism, and I'm not willing to do that. I'm not willing to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that there are problems within feminism, but I think that stepping away from it or trying to do nothing about those problems is just as problematic as some of the issues that are going on in contemporary feminism.
Well, you're right, because in the 1960s and 70s, when the women's movement was really coming up, you had people like Gloria Steinem, mm-hmm. Betty Friedan, but these were upper class, middle class, white women.
Yes.
Who, you know, there were, of course, black women involved.
Yes,
in the movement,
there were, absolutely were.
But you're right. They were the faces.
They were
the faces of the movement.
And, you know, I don't want to discount what those women did either. They did amazing things, but it always seems like there was a cost to what they did for a lot of women whose needs and interests were not served. And so, you know, I'm human and I'm nowhere near doing my best, but I'm trying to always get better in terms of thinking about the multiple identities that people inhabit, that you're not just a woman, that you are also, you have a race or ethnicity, you also have a sexuality, and gender even comes into it, because feminism has long failed transgender women. And
well, that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure what was the discussion about transgender in the 60s and 70s.
I don't think the discussion really began until the 80s and 90s. Uh-huh. I think it was still too new. And people who were transgender were very underground. And there was some rising of a movement in the 70s and 80s. But I think it's now that we're really seeing transgender men and women moving to the forefront and saying, we are equal and we deserve the same consideration and we'll fight for you, but you damn well need to fight for us as well. And some feminists are reluctant to do that, unfortunately.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Roxane Gay. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is novelist and essayist Roxane Gay. Ms. Gay's debut novel, An Untamed State, is the harrowing story of a Haitian-American woman who is kidnapped while visiting her parents in Port-au-Prince. She is also the author of a collection of essays entitled Bad Feminist. Roxane, in your book, A Bad Feminist, you talk about rape jokes.
Yes.
Can a rape joke ever be funny?
To me, not necessarily. Though, since writing that essay, I have heard a couple funny rape jokes. Wanda Sykes does a really great rape joke. I think it depends on who the subject or object of the humor is in the rape joke that determines whether or not it can be funny. But, and this is something I try to make clear in my writing, I can't control what other people find funny, because Lord knows there are many things that I find funny that people are like, oh, no, that's totally inappropriate. And so I'm not about censorship, especially as a writer. But it does trouble me that rape humor is all too often lazy, and it focuses on the victim instead of the rapist. And it doesn't do anything to challenge rape culture. And so really what I want to say is, instead of no rape jokes, hey, let's have some better rape jokes. And if you can't tell a good rape joke, then don't tell one. Just find something else.
Well, in that essay, in an essay on rape jokes, you went after a comedian named Daniel Tosh.
Yes.
Who suggested that a heckler at one of his shows should be gang raped.
Yes.
It was a joke, he said later. And several male comedians came to his defense. Mm-hmm. Louis C.K., Chris Rock, Patton Oswalt. They cited free speech and condemned political correctness. But what about Michael Richards, the former star of Seinfeld? When he called a heckler the N-word, no one came to his defense. He was denounced.
Yes.
Was there a double standard?
Absolutely. Again, it shows, I think, the status of women. That's okay, but don't use the N-word, which I agree with. Don't use that word. But I do think there's a double standard. And I also think that these comedians misunderstand something. Free speech doesn't mean that you are free from consequence. You are free to say whatever you want all day long. I am free to critique it. And I'm free to think that's nonsense. And I really wish you wouldn't do it. It's just they want to be able to make these jokes without any sort of response that they don't appreciate. And that's just not how it works. Free speech goes both ways.
Well, Donald Sterling, the owner of the LA Clippers, is a perfect example of that. I was thinking of Sterling when I read your essay on Paula Deen.
Yes.
The Southern cook who got into trouble for racist comments. You say that Deen broke the unspoken rules about racism. I think you would agree that Sterling broke them too.
Yes.
What are the unspoken rules of racism? What are they?
I think that there are these unspoken rules that you keep it at home. You keep it in the family. Like, yes, we're going to make these off-color racist jokes, or we're going to use off-color and racist language, but we don't do it in public. We don't do it around outside of the circle of trust. And when you look at Paula Deen, someone breached her circle of trust. And, you know, I don't hate Paula Deen. I think that Paula Deen is a woman of a certain age from the South. And I don't think that all Southern women in their 60s are racist. And I don't, you know, but I think that Paula Deen was behaving exactly the way she behaves every single day, and then she just got caught. And everyone acts all surprised because we have this idea that we hide our racism. And if we keep it hidden and we act properly in the streets and act politically correct in the streets, then we're doing okay. And Paula Deen showed us that that's not the case. And then Donald Sterling, Donald Sterling is just on a whole other level. That's just a very, very rich man who gets to do whatever he wants. And his life really isn't going to change that much, even with this. He's still going to be a billionaire no matter what happens. And, you know, he's a racist, but he has a black mistress. So that tells you something very interesting about his racism. I think it's more born out of self-loathing than anything else as far as he's concerned. And that the response has been very fascinating, particularly when people have said that the players are the ones who should draw the line in the sand and say, we're not going to play until he's kicked out of the league, as if the owners bear no responsibility. It's an interesting situation.
We're speaking with Roxane Gay, whose new novel is Untamed State. She's also the author of a collection of essays entitled Bad Feminist. Roxane, what do you have to say to women who love Chris Brown so much they would let him beat them?
I would just say, oh, young women, stop and really think about what you're worth. Chris Brown, I don't understand his appeal because I'm older. I'm 39 and I just look at him and I see a little boy. And his music is catchy at times, but I just don't get the Chris Brown thing. But I do understand that there are young women who do love Chris Brown. And what disturbs me is, especially after he was arrested and in trouble for beating his then girlfriend Rihanna, there were women who said that they would let him beat them because he's so attractive and they want to be with him. And I just think that you're willing to compromise yourself in that way. Why? Let's look at that. And I think you deserve better as young women. And so that's definitely where I was going with that essay. And I still believe that. It just breaks my heart when I see that. I just think there is something better out there than Chris Brown. I promise you. Look at
What about women who beat Jay-Z?
I just got asked to write about that. That's different. No.
Well, how do you react to the video of Beyonce's sister slapping her brother-in-law?
I must admit, I think it's the most hilarious thing I've ever seen. I can't get enough. I just want to know every single thing about what's going on there. And I know that's deeply inconsistent. Again, bad feminist. But like, why was she doing that? And then Beyonce's in the corner, like on some kind of tranquilizer, just totally calm. And I'm obsessed. Like, what did Jay-Z do to make Solange so angry? It's fascinating.
The feminist critic Bell Hooks called Beyoncé anti-feminist.
Yes.
Because of her scantily clad club cover on Time Magazine's 100 Most Interesting People issue.
Yes.
Do you agree with Books?
No.
Is she anti-feminist?
Absolutely not. I actually wrote a piece for The Guardian yesterday that I disagree with Hooks. I really admire Hooks, and I think nothing but the best of her scholarship and her feminism. But I also think that feminists have a very nasty habit of deciding who's a good feminist and who's a bad feminist. And she called Beyoncé a terrorist. No, a terrorist is actually a terrorist. Beyoncé is a musician, and I think she's playing the game. But I think of all the women artists out there right now, Beyoncé is one of them who actually does have some control over her image. I mean, I don't think we have to delude ourselves that sex sells. And I think Beyoncé is very willingly playing a game. But I think she's in control of her image to an extent. And I think that's a really good model for young women. And I think that you can be a role model and be sexual. And if I had Beyoncé's body, I would wear even less than she was wearing.
Well, recently you wrote an article for the New York Times critiquing The Bachelor and The Bachelorette.
God, I have a lot of opinions.
Popular, you're so opinionated. Two popular reality TV shows. You compare them to fairy tales, which used to be the public's first exposure to literature. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the
absolutely
first time. The first stories we ever heard, or some of us heard, were fairy tales. Some girls grow up wanting a fairy tale existence. Should they reconsider that fantasy?
I never want to deny young girls what they enjoy, but I do think that they have to reconsider their role within the fairy tale. All too often, women suffer in fairy tales. They eat a poison apple and they need to be saved. They get locked up in a tower. They have to spin hay into gold, all at the whims of a man. And so I do think that you should, young girls want to believe in fairy tales, that's great, but believe in fairy tales where you get to be the hero and where you get to have some sort of power. I have two nieces who are 2 and 3, and they both love princesses and fairy tales, and I am not going to be the one to rain on their parade and try and take away their joy, but I am also going to be the one who's there to help them find the kinds of fairy tales and stories where they get to recognize themselves as strong and actualized young women. I think you can do both. You don't have to deny young girls their favorite things, but you can show them alternatives that might be in their better interest.
Well, I'm reminded of that scene in Pretty Woman,
yes,
when Julia Roberts is sitting with her friend by the pool, and her friend says, "What do you want out of life?" And Julia Roberts says, "I want the fairy tale," but who's ever gotten that? Mm-hmm. And then her friend says, "Cinderella."
Yes.
But what's not really noticed about that scene is that this friend, who is the only female friend she has in the entire movie, mm-hmm, is the one who got her into prostitution in L.A. Mm-hmm. So that's complicated.
It is. It's very, and that's actually one of my favorite movies.
Well, it has a lot of problems.
So many problems. But I do think that you can see that movie where she does want the fairy tale. And, you know, in the piece I wrote for the New York Times, I was definitely struggling with that, you know, I recognize how damaging these things are. But I, too, still think I wouldn't mind the fairy tale. I really wouldn't mind it. And I think those things are hard to reconcile at times. And when I look at a movie like Pretty Woman, well, she actually ended up getting the fairy tale, the billionaire, the limo, Princess Vivian.
All right, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Roxane Gay. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is novelist and essayist Roxane Gay. Ms. Gay's new novel, An Untamed State, is the story of a Haitian-American woman who is kidnapped while visiting her parents in Port-au-Prince. She is also the author of a collection of essays entitled Bad Feminist. Roxanne, in your book, Bad Feminist, you write about The Help.
Yes.
A extremely popular movie set in 1960s Mississippi at the height of the Civil Rights era. This movie made you very angry. Mm-hmm. Why?
The Help was its own kind of fairy tale, this sort of delusional revision of history where Black women were more than happy to be the help and they were led to salvation by a teenager. Come on.
Emma Stone.
Yes. And what was particularly infuriating about The Help was that the movie was so well done. Like, the production values were impeccable, the directing, the acting. And so all of that energy couldn't have been put to better use. My frustration really was with the source material, the novel The Help, which has so many problems. And again, it's about who gets to be empowered. And it's... It just frustrated me quite a lot.
Well, you mentioned something called the magical Negro.
Yes.
What is the magical Negro?
The magical Negro is a character you see in a lot of movies where there's a Black person that helps a white person reach understanding or some kind of redemption or salvation. The Legend of Bagger Vance, Hitch, and those both were those.
The Shining.
I haven't even seen The Shining.
Oh, no, you really should, because the kid is helped by this Black man, older Black man who has telepathic powers.
Excellent.
Too.
Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
The Green Mile. It's everywhere. And
yeah, Stephen King loves magical Negroes, by the
yes,
way.
Yes, I'm not surprised to hear that, actually.
He loves magical Negroes.
And it's somehow, these people have the magical powers to help the white people, but they never quite have the powers to help themselves. And so it becomes frustrating to see this trope time and time again. And in The Help, it was just like a debauchery of magical Negroes everywhere. And Minnie was helping the woman she worked with, whose name I'm not remembering, get over her miscarriages and learn how to cook. And then Abilene was helping her young charge feel good about herself and develop self-esteem while she mourned her own son who was dead. And it was just seeing all of this energy go towards something other than themselves that became very frustrating. Now, the reality is that Black women were the help, and I don't dispute that, and I don't have any issue with that, and I think their stories matter. It was how their stories were mediated that I was frustrated by.
I don't know if you're familiar with Key and Poole. Key and Poole have a show on Comedy Central.
Yes.
And there's a skit they had recently where Key and Poole, they played a janitor and a copier repairman in the office of a wealthy white businessman. Mm-hmm. And they both go, they have magical powers. And they have this Hogwarts-worthy battle right in the office. And this was their way of joking about the magical Negro.
That
they really were magical Negroes. You also note in that essay that there, in the movie, there's no indication of the sexual harassment or mm-hmm. violence that these Black women at that time suffered mm-hmm. at the hands of their white employers. I was wondering if you've ever read Danielle McGuire's book, At the Dark End of the Street.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I think you should, because okay. It's interesting. It's in 1944, a Black woman in Alabama was gang raped by several white men.
Mm-hmm.
And the president of the local chapter of the NAACP sent someone to investigate it. The investigator's name was Rosa Parks. Now, 11 years later, Rosa Parks would become famous for not getting in the back of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sexual violence against Black women, not seating arrangements in public transportation, that really got her into the civil rights movement.
I had no idea.
Okay, so I'm just saying that that's because in The Help, there is no sexual harassment at all.
And I don't think it was something that happened to every woman, but it was just completely glossed over. It was ignored. And the reality of Jim Crow was completely ignored. And that was frustrating because it made the South seem like a much more genteel place in the 60s than it was, especially Jackson, Mississippi. That was not, that was not a joyful place oftentimes for Black people. And you know, it's hard. Again, it comes to that question of what do you do with artistic freedom, but use your artistic freedom responsibly. In the book, Catherine Stockett has Abilene referring to herself as black as a cockroach. Now, I've heard of black people referring to themselves as a great many things. I have never in my life heard someone refer to themselves as black like a cockroach. And so it's that kind of lack of ethics in the writing that really just got under my skin.
We're speaking with Roxane Gay, whose new novel is An Untamed State. She's also written a collection of essays entitled Bad Feminist. In Bad Feminist, you also take issue with two movies that deal with slavery, Django Unchained and 12 Years a Slave. What did you not like about those movies?
Django Unchained, I am not a fan of Quentin Tarantino. And I thought that he was extraordinarily gratuitous in his use of the N-word. And
but he's always been like that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. This is no, oh, I have issues with most of every of his movies. I just don't like, I'm not a Tarantino fan. And right. So I make that clear. Like, I'm just not his target audience. But I just thought that movie was gratuitous. And I understand what he was going for. And I understand why people like it. But it was not the movie for me. And
well, the character Broomhilda, played by Kerry Washington, she's a footnote. She's a cipher.
Yes.
And yet she's the one who you can imagine is suffering the most.
Correct.
The thing I found fascinating about that movie is there is an implication of rape or gang rape in the sense that she's a comfort woman.
Yes.
But that's just touched upon. They just mention it and then they leave it alone.
They just write it. And then there's when they're visiting that one plantation and you see the quote unquote slaves well dressed and swinging and skipping around the plantation. I know it's a movie, but you can't have that and then also have scenes where you see a slave. Like where Broomhilda is, her back is bared and we see the braids of scars on her back. And I mean, it's like two different movies were going on there. Either do it all with this sort of false idyll or do it all toward the more brutal reality. But to try and mix both, I found the mix or the combination quite jarring. 12 Years a Slave, I think, is a brilliantly made movie. I think Steve McQueen is really talented. Again, I'm just burnt out on slavery movies. I think it was just too much. It was so graphic and so violent, and I understand why. And I just was like, was anyone under the delusion that slavery wasn't this terrible? Who is this movie for?
Well, Cliven, the rancher in
Nevada,
he didn't think slavery was that
bad. It gave those boys something to do.
Cliven Bundy.
Yes.
He thought it was, hey, good old time.
I mean, you know, gosh.
Sadly, there are people who believe that.
There really are people who believe that slavery wasn't so bad, and that's heartbreaking. And so I'm glad the movie exists for that reason. When I wrote the essay about 12 Years a Slave, again, I don't have an issue with the movie existing, and I absolutely recognize its merit, but I wish that we could have movies with black casts and black directors that weren't so grounded in the struggle. Like, sometimes we have happy lives and good days, and sometimes we want to be parts of romantic comedies. Like, we just never get to have mainstream movies that tell mainstream stories. It's always about the struggle and the civil rights era, and those stories need to be told, but we have other stories, and I wonder at what point do we get to tell our other stories? And so that was my main issue there.
What is the politics of respectability?
The politics of respectability is this sense that when you're a person of color, when you're another, you have to be on your best behavior at all times. You have to act right in order to be treated right. And I find the politics of respectability extraordinarily frustrating as a black woman, as a Haitian American woman, that we are, you know, we can't let our dirty laundry out. We can't be our true selves. We have to only be our best selves at all times. I think that's an unreasonable burden that only people who are othered and who are underrepresented are forced into.
Well, you discussed Bill Cosby and the CNN anchor Don Lemon. Don Lemon got into a lot of trouble.
Yes, he did.
Because of his comments, because he was like five things?
Yes, five things black people can do to improve. I can't even remember the title of it, but he did this segment where he talked about five things that essentially black people can do to improve their lives. I'm all about the improvement of black people and frankly all people throughout the world, but many of his suggestions were condescending and the things that he was addressing were things that people do everywhere. Like one of the things he talked about was, you know, when he goes to Harlem, he notices how it's dirtier and that people litter. I live in the country. I promise you, white people litter. So it just seems like instead of trying to combat racism, there's this sense that if we behave well enough, white people will love us. And that's sad to me that you think that you can earn equality through respectability.
You're modeling yourself after the majority.
Correct. And I think that respect should be given regardless. Equality should be given regardless. You don't have to sing for your supper. No one looks at white people doing terrible things and say, you know, act better for the race. They just don't have to do that. And so I don't think that anyone else should have to do that either. I think people should be good and decent. I think we should be our best selves, absolutely. But I don't think we should be our best selves to get equal consideration.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Roxane Gay.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. You can see his reviews and blog on the Huffington Post. He also reviews books for the Miami Herald and for Topical Currents. And that's our program for this Monday. Thank you for being with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and links to today's program. More information, links, and photos also at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's Topical Currents focuses on the LGBT community. We'll visit with George Valencia of Point Foundation. They empower promising LGBT students to achieve their full academic and leadership potential. And it's the nation's largest scholarship-granting organization for LGBT students of merit. We'll also visit with two of the scholars. Bonnie Berman wishing you a great Monday. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News. Thanks so much for being with us.